This summer, it's hot. We don't need to tell you. America's been suffering a catastrophic heat wave for more than a month. No part of the country has been immune. That means people are scrambling to cope. Recently, the president even issued the country's first ever heat wave hazard alert for workers. But there's one obvious no-brainer option for staying cool. And across the country, it's failing.
There should be no excuses to have any pools in Baltimore closed.
Warm summer days ahead. Many city residents want to cool off at one of the city pools across Jacksonville. The pools opened earlier this month, but when we checked them today, our crews found pools shuttered and even one with green water.
It's a pool that has needed renovations since 20, 30 years ago. However, due to heavy rains...
More than half of Boston city pools closed this summer. Same thing happened in Jacksonville. And in Atlanta, all the outdoor public pools closed for the rest of the summer, before July even ended. Pool closures have plagued American cities for years. Officials blame crumbling infrastructure and recently lifeguard shortages. About a third of the nation's public pools were affected by staffing issues last year. According to the American Lifeguard Association, 2023 is as bad or worse.
We really just haven't prioritized swimming in this country.
Mara Gay writes for the New York Times editorial board. She's written about America's deteriorating public pools for years, calls it a personal obsession.
It is a public health crisis. There are 4,000 Americans who die of drowning every year. It's the leading cause of death for children 1 to 4, and one of the leading causes of death for children overall. And yet we think of swimming in the United States like a luxury. That's how it's treated, rather than a human right, which I believe it to be.
There are more than 10 million private pools in America, but Mara says there are just 300,000 public ones. And that's not just an inconvenience. It's a public health disaster.
It's not only heartbreaking, it makes me angry because since Americans don't have a safe place to swim or learn how to swim, they're drowning instead. When I go out in Brooklyn and I see kids playing in the sprinkler of a public housing project when they could be swimming in a pool, it makes me very angry and very sad. I don't think we should have something so basic and elemental and just human as swimming be off limits to anyone.
Today on the show, America is hotter than ever. So, where are the pools? I'm Mary C. Curtis, in for Mary Harris. You're listening to What Next? Stick around.
This episode is brought to you by Discover. When it comes to your finances, Discover wants you to know they are the credit card that is always there for you. With 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, that means no more waiting for, quote, normal business hours just to get a hold of someone. We are talking real service from real people whenever you need it. Get the customer service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity, much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save, too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at Progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
A 1933 survey of Americans' leisure activities found that just as many people swam for fun as went to the movies. So I'd like to get a little bit into the background. How many public pools were around in the 1920s and 1930s?
During the Great Depression, the country invested in building dozens, scores of public pools, large public pools across the country under the Works Progress Administration under FDR. And so you had pools like the Astoria Pool in New York. You had the Audubon Pool in New Orleans that came a little before that time. And these were meant to be enjoyed. And they were large public pools. And so that was kind of an exciting era. But of course, what we also know, we have to remember, is that these pools were segregated, many of them, most of them, by race. And so Black Americans found themselves shut out of many, many pools across the country that were meant for the public.
That all changed after World War II and after Brown v. Board of Education. Mandated integration led to a mass exodus of white Americans from cities to the suburbs. And after that, the number of private swim clubs exploded, and public pools languished. Some were simply neglected. Others were padlocked or filled in with concrete.
You know, you had this kind of slow movement away from public pools as an essential piece of infrastructure. And instead, you had wealthier Americans, white Americans, who were building private pools in their backyards, who were joining country clubs, or, you know, even creating just homeowner associations with pools and kind of withdrawing into that private space. And so you have now a situation where generations of some American families have been swimming and generations of others have been unable to learn, afraid of the water, timid around the water. It's really endemic, and it's so solvable. And that's what really gets me going.
Let's talk about what really happened to public pools. What do they look like? Because a lot of people, when they talk about them, it's really not with affection.
One of the secrets in America is that wealthier communities actually never stopped investing in their public pools. So whereas many of us who live in big cities like New York, you think of our public pools, and of course, they're a critical amenity and resource. At the same time, they're surrounded by concrete. They are filled with rules, like the kind of color shirt you can wear. You have to shower first. You have to bring a lock. The lines are often really long. The hours are sometimes erratic. And it's not really designed necessarily to make you feel like this is somewhere that you want to be. And that is, I think, really a miscarriage of justice to the public, because there are wealthier communities across the United States, including in the New York suburbs, and certainly not limited to that, whose public pools are the crown jewel of their towns. I mean, we know the town of Scarsdale, which is a community in Westchester, a wealthy community in Westchester, has a beautiful town pool surrounded by beautiful, perfectly mowed lawns. We know that public pools are a value add. We know so because these wealthy communities never stopped investing in them. And that, for me, really tells you everything you need to know.
Why are public pools then, and parks for that matter, not a priority for so many city governments?
That's a great question. Every city budget, I've covered many city budgets. It's really frustrating because you have to prioritize. You know, America, as Americans feel the heat from climate change during the summer, my hope is that they will be clamoring for more pools. But it's hard because you're competing with police departments, right, for budgets. You're competing with all kinds of other needs. And it's not to say that any of those aren't important. Of course, many of them are. It's just to say that this is not something that is a luxury. This is actually just essential.
You argue that the lack of public pools in America isn't just annoying or an inconvenience, particularly in the heat, but it's dangerous. Why is that?
Well, one reason is that when Americans don't have a public pool that is enjoyable to visit and easily accessible, they are unlikely to learn how to swim. a majority of Americans, according to a Red Cross survey, cannot swim or swim well. So the other reason is that when Americans don't have a safe place to swim, some of them will seek somewhere else to swim instead. And so that can look very dangerous. At least 4 teenagers have drowned, for example, in the Bronx River here in New York City. In the past decade or so, there are 8 working public pools in the Bronx for a population of 1.4 million people. So that's a really painful example of what can happen when you don't invest in these pools.
Do we know how common it is for Americans to die of drowning?
So drowning is the number one cause of death for Americans 1 to 4 years old. It is the number 2 cause of death for the next age group. And it is one of the leading causes of death for all Americans under the age of 24. So this is a public health crisis. 4,000 Americans drown every year. That's an average of 11 people a day that we're losing to drowning. And then you have about double that in near fatal drownings, which can be very serious medical events and sometimes life-altering ones.
Well, it's interesting because you've talked about these cases, and so often these deaths are treated as, well, that's very sad, it's an accident, it's a personal tragedy for the family. But there is something much broader and systemic to this problem.
Yeah, thank you for bringing that up. You know, I think when you do spend months talking to people who, of all backgrounds, have lost children to drowning, you learn a lot of things. And it's not only about personal tragedy. One of the stories that brought this home for me, I interviewed a woman named Rachel Ross, who lost her daughter, Benasia, to drowning as an adolescent. And they lived in New Orleans, which is a city that once had the largest public swimming pool in the southern United States, the Audubon Natatorium. But that pool closed in the 60s rather than open up to Black swimmers. And then it reopened years later under a much smaller footprint. So the pool is not what it was. And, you know, Ms. Ross talked a lot to me about her children and her daughter, Benasia, especially loving the water, always wanting to go swimming. And, you know, Ms. Ross was a single mom. She didn't have a ton of money or time to take her kids to the pool, and she herself didn't know how to swim. But anything she could do to get her kids, you know, near the water, she would. And, you know, there weren't a lot of easily accessible public pools for them to get to. So one day, you know, when they were invited to a barbecue, a friend of a friend's house, they just left it the chance to go swim. These folks had a pool, and the pool doesn't sound like was very well maintained. And so actually, when Benasia drowned, her body was in the water for several minutes, floating just beneath the surface before anyone noticed her, because the water was that dirty, according to her mother. So this is a Black family in New Orleans that is just but one story in a country that has allowed generations to go without access to the water. It runs really deep in this country, and not just for Black Americans. And I think there's this perception in general in the United States, especially right now, you know, each man out for himself. And I really do believe that we're all poorer when we think about life that way and public goods that way. And I think this is a really brutal example of that.
I know that you've said that every group is affected, but I'm really glad you brought up the case of Ms. Ross. It seems like certain groups are most at risk, and these are the same groups that are least likely to know how to swim. So we do see these patterns. Why is that?
Oh, it really goes deep, as you know. Really all the way back to slavery, when Black Americans were not only not allowed to read, which is, I think, more widely known, but oftentimes dissuaded from learning how to swim because that would have made it easier for them to escape enslavement. And also dogs could not track your scent through water. And so that's how deep this history runs. You know, I also just want to say, let me put it this way. When you think about the cost of racism, of anti-Black racism in the United States, it not only affects Black Americans, which should be reason enough for us to address this, it affects everyone. So this really is a national problem. It's a national crisis. Its history runs, as many of our national crises do, through the history of white supremacy and of slavery and Jim Crow in the United States. I've even heard from people who are wealthy who can't find a place to swim in cities like New York, for example. If you don't have a backyard swimming pool, or if you don't belong to a country club, it seems you're out of luck. And I hope that that makes Americans of many backgrounds as angry as it makes me.
After the break, how to fix our public pool crisis. Well, this summer, we did have a coalition of researchers publish the first ever U.S. Water Safety Action Plan that aims to reduce drownings over the next 10 years. What kinds of recommendations are in there?
Yeah, so this is great because the United States is actually one of the only countries, one of the only Western countries that doesn't have a water safety plan, which is a real issue. And so those experts have called for the government, the White House and Congress to develop a national surveillance plan, a data surveillance plan for drowning as a public health crisis, which is really key because we need much more information about how and why and where these drownings are happening in order to prevent them. But they've also called for public awareness campaigns around water safety in general. And that can be anything from wearing a life vest while boating in open water to knowing if your child is at increased risk or if you're at increased risk as an adult. Children with autism are at increased risk, for example. 80% of children who drown are boys. So we know that boys are at increased risk. So I think there's a lot in that plan that can hopefully be taken and run away with the federal government.
This plan was developed by nonprofits and experts and not the federal government. You said maybe the federal government could take some tips.
Right. So one of the key recommendations in the water safety plan is an ask for the federal government to designate a federal agency, a single federal agency, to oversee drowning prevention in the United States. This should be, in my opinion, the work of government. You know, I don't want to denigrate the dozens of exceptional nonprofits across the country doing the work that the government so far has failed to do, but they cannot possibly reach every American. Even organizations that are well-known like the Red Cross or the YMCA cannot possibly teach every American how to swim, let alone do they have the pools to do so or the funding to do so. So this is really something that the government, I believe, needs to address and needs to take ownership of.
But when we're talking about solutions, it seems that there are two branches of solutions here, the infrastructure piece and then the education piece. So let's start with the infrastructure. What do you think it would take to build more public pools and to do something about the ones that already exist?
So the federal government is the entity that has the kind of funding that would be necessary to build a critical mass, which is what we really need, of public pools across the United States. But I also would hope that, you know, we're starting a conversation here. There are communities across the country, city, county officials who may say, hey, I may not have the budget to build a public pool right now, but we could renovate ours. We could reopen the one in the school that we have downtown. Or, hey, maybe we can keep it open a little bit longer. Maybe we can pay the lifeguards a little more. Or if you are a town that sits on a river or a lake, maybe we can put up some signage across that body of water to tell people where it's safer to swim or how deep the water is. Is it deep enough to dive? What's the current like? These are just very practical changes, I think, that could make an enormous difference.
What about the education piece? I know roughly half of all Americans either can't swim or can't swim very well. So what are some common misconceptions around swimming, and how do we ensure that more Americans learn to swim correctly?
It's a great question. You know, part of learning how to swim is learning how to decide when and where it's safe to swim and when and where it may not be safe to swim. So for example, being able to say to yourself, well, you know what, the ocean's a little too rough for me today. What do you do if there's an undertow? How do you deal with a riptide? These are just some basic and very practical things and steps that can be taken. But I think overall, the approach has to change. You know, in the United States at this point, very few people, I believe, would allow their children or even themselves would want to go to a restaurant where you could smoke cigarettes all day. Very few people would put their infant in a car without a car seat. And yet, in the United States, a majority of Americans don't have the swimming skills needed to swim safely. And really, we're on our own.
So why do you love the water?
I think there's something about floating in a pool or in the ocean in particular for me that makes me feel like a child again, free to play, to be buoyant, to be silly, and to feel kind of strong in my body, but also kind of at one with nature. I am a Black American, and my father and his five siblings grew up, you know, in part in South Carolina, actually, during Jim Crow. And I think in our family, swimming was really prized as a symbol of just how joy can be like resistance. Just that special joy from reclaiming a human experience that had been denied to Black Americans for so long and passing that down to me as an inheritance. And the way I look at that inheritance, it's meant to be shared. It's meant to be for all of us. It's not something special that I should get because I grew up upper middle class. That's not what I was taught. That's not what I believe. This is a human right. And even if you end up not loving it as much as I do, you still deserve the chance to give it a try.
Thank you so much, Mara Gay, for joining us on What Next.
Thank you for having me, Mary. It's been great.
Mara Gay is a member of the New York Times editorial board. That's the show. If you're a fan of What Next, the best way to support our work is to join Slate Plus. Go to slate.com/whatnextplus to sign up. What Next is produced by Elena Schwartz, Rob Gunther, Anna Phillips, Paige Osborne, and Madeline Ducharme. We're led by Alicia Montgomery, with a little help from Susan Matthews. Ben Richman is the Senior Director of Podcast Operations here at Slate. And I'm Mary C. Curtis, columnist at Roll Call and host of its Equal Time podcast. Find me on Twitter. I'm @mcurtisnc3. Thanks for listening. Talk to you soon.